Welcome to the South Cars Outreach Program. Join our training session in progress.
Program sponsored by the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This program has been established to help those wishing to learn more about our hobby and further assist those wishing to upgrade license status. The program tonight will be an in-depth course pertaining to what one should know when studying for the general class license. This course will be conducted with two sessions weekly, which will be at 7 p.m., that's 2300 Zulu, each Tuesday, and at 7 p.m. each Sunday evening. For those that are already licensed and wish either a refresher course or would just like to listen, please connect to our SCAR server at either EchoLink node number 96140 or IRLP node 9614. For those who are interested, please contact myself, Mike, Kilo Delta Zero, Charlie Delta Quebec, via email at voip@voipnet.southcars.com to enroll in this class and to be given directions as to the study material required and the manner you will be connected into the course. Letting it drop. The material being presented is formatted from data obtained from the AWRL and is simply being forwarded in a presentation format by South Coast Amateur Radio Service. Should anyone take issue to some of the technical statements made, and in keeping with not interrupting the class and session, please convey your comments or suggestions to the outreach program at voip@voipnet.southcars.com. It should be mentioned that this course covers only the requirements pertaining to United States Part 97 rules and does not include other requirements that may be found in foreign countries. Should any other country other than the United States wish to have their own licensing session on this server, please drop us an email at voip@voipnet.southcars.com. The session this evening will be recorded and posted on our website, and it's posted at www.voip.southcars.com. Now please note, for all of our class members and instructors, it is extremely important that we all stay on the same page during these classes. The only question pool and copy thereof that should be used when participating in this class should be the one found posted in our website. Publications from other sources may or may not be current and should not be used during the sessions. Do we have any emergency or out of the ordinary business that needs to be handled before we start this evening's program? Over. Okay, to give you a chance to tune up your radios, out here in Kansas, we're running 90 degrees, high humidity, and the blue sky continues to have a little bit of a gray hue to it. We're still getting the smoke from the forest fires in Canada coming down from Western Canada, still coming across the Midwest. So whether it helps or not, I don't know. But at this point, let us begin. Now, we're going to be reviewing general classes. This is the third session, and tonight we have KC2RMO, Gary, and we also have W4RFJ, Roger, will be your instructors this evening. So tonight, if I have this right, we're going to start with Gary. So Gary, KC2RMO, take it away. Over.
And we thank you, sir. And hello there, Mike, and hello, Roger, and hello, Gordon and Kathy, and hello to all you future general licensees. By the way, Mike, I saw that weather map, and holy cow, you guys are not looking like it's too comfortable up there. This is one time it's kind of good to be in Syracuse. But let's get things going right now. We're talking about propagation a lot here. We're in the G3 section. So let's kick it off with, what is the significance of the sunspot number with regard to HF propagation? Now here's your choices. A, higher sunspot numbers generally indicate a greater probability of good propagation at higher frequencies. B, lower sunspot numbers generally indicate probability of sporadic E propagation. C, A zero sunspot number indicates radio propagation is not possible on any band, or D, all these choices are correct. In this case, all these choices are correct is not the correct answer. The one you want is A. Higher sunspot numbers generally indicate a greater probability of good propagation at higher frequencies. The one thing you want to remember about propagation, this is maybe a new word to a lot of folks here. Let me just buy a nickel. The one thing you want to remember about propagation is that maybe two basics in mind. Okay, number one, that the sun has a lot to do with it. And two, it's predictable, but it's unpredictable. Okay, but there's general rules that you can kind of keep in your bag of tricks. And that answer A is one of those general rules. Higher sunspot numbers generally indicate a greater probability of good propagation at higher frequencies. If you know that, then you're pointing in the right direction. Do we have any questions right now? Take a break. Nope, no questions, nothing heard, so we'll turn it over to Roger tonight for question number two. Roger, hello there, and what have you for us right now?
Good morning, Gary. Actually, it's afternoon, evening in a lot of parts of the world, but I figured for those daytime people like getting up early, good morning. Anyway, top of the evening to everybody. I'd like to add just a little bit to what you just said, Gary. You know, the sunspot number usually gives us an indication of how much ultraviolet energy or solar flux we'll have hitting the atmosphere of the Earth. So the sunspot number with regard to HF propagation, Gary's absolutely correct. The more solar flux you have, the higher the sunspot number, the thicker the ionosphere gets, your different layers, and the more thicker, the higher the frequency it'll react with. Anyway, let me grab a nickel. My question is, which of the following are least reliable for long-distance communications during periods of low solar activity? And the answers are A, 80 meters and 160 meters, B, 60 meters and 40 meters, C, 30 meters and 20 meters, and last but not least, D, 15 meters, 12 meters, and 10 meters. Let me take a pause here. And Gary, am I doing this right? This is my first time, so I don't want to mess it up too much. I know we're recording it, and I don't think Gordon will be able to get me edited out that easily. Over.
Hey, it's my first time too. So what we want to do is at this point to let the folks know what is the correct answer for the question, and then maybe we can tell them a little bit about that. You want to go for it, or I could pick it up too?
No, I got it. I got it. Thank you very much, Gary. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the answer is D, 15, 12, and 10 meters. Becomes almost unreliable during periods of low solar activity. And I think what we mean by solar activity is, you know, the sunspot number. The sunspot number usually gives us, the higher the sunspot number, the higher the activity. The higher the activity, the more ultraviolet rays. The more ultraviolet rays, the more it causes the ionosphere to actually react. The unused atoms up there in the ionosphere actually get electrons knocked off of them, and that's those electrons that react to the frequencies that we're transmitting. So the less electrons you have, the harder it is to utilize the ionosphere to bounce your signals off in the higher frequency bands. I'll pause here and we'll see if we can get some questions going. This is W4RFJ.
6, Victor.
Go ahead, Gordon.
Well, thank you, Mike. Good evening to you, and hello, Raj, and hi, Gary. Hey, just one quick comment. I would suggest you gentlemen, when you start off your question, give the question number also, if you'd be so kind. The people out there will be following, I suspect, their question pool. And if they want to make any notes, they can make it right on the question pool. So if you'd start off with a number, I think it might help. Go ahead, Raj, KY6V, and thank you.
See, I knew I'd mess up there somehow, but the question number that I just read was G3A04. I take it nobody else has any questions. If not, Gary, I guess it's over to you. Over.
Hey, thank you, Roger. And great explanation, by the way, of how that all works. I think the one thing that becomes very important or one of the bigger concepts that you have to latch onto when you become a general class licensee is that when you're working HF, you're relying a lot on the atmosphere. You know, when you're a technician, you know, unless you're doing 10 meters or what have you, generally you're on 2 and above, and you're just basically doing local work. You know, you're not really so much concerned with what the atmosphere is doing. You just want to hit the repeater and do your thing. When you go on to becoming a general, you know, you're relying on this crazy thing that's called the Earth's atmosphere, and it's a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than you might have ever imagined. There's a lot going on up there. So let's move along now. We're on question number 3, and this is G3A07. And the question is, at what point in the solar cycle does the 20-meter band usually support worldwide propagation during daylight hours? Now, here's your choices. A, at the summer solstice. B, only at the maximum point of the solar cycle. C, only at the minimum point of the solar cycle. Or D, at any point in the solar cycle. And the answer, of course, is D. D as in dog. 20 meters is a phenomenal daytime DX band. I spend a lot of time on 20. You can go great places on 20. It's amazing what you can do. As you become more familiar with the HF bands and the DX bands like 20, you'll find that 20 is probably the most reliable band. It's the one that you can count on to take you long distances consistently, and that doesn't really at any point during the solar cycle, it's gonna get you where you want to go. So 20 meters is a very good choice if you want to work long distance. So we'll take a break at this point in time, and let's see if anybody has any questions regarding that question.
This is KD0CDQ. To add to the last two questions, those of you who want to keep track of the solar activity and you follow ARRL, just about every 3 days or every week, they send you a forecast of what they suspect the solar situation will be. That's a free service that you get in one of those nuisance emails from ARRL. But it can be useful. Okay, KD0CDQ, and I'm throwing it back to W4RFJ. Go right ahead, please.
And thank you, Mike. This is W4RFJ, and I'm tasked with question number 4, that is G3 Alpha 16. What is the possible benefit to radio communications resulting from from periods of high geomagnetic activity? The answers are as follows. A, auroras that can reflect VHF signals. B, higher signal strength for HF signals passing through the polar regions. C, improved HF long path propagation. And D, reduced long delayed echoes. Well, the answer, ladies and gentlemen, is A. Auroras that can reflect VHF signals. During periods of high geomagnetic activity, we find that the northern lights become very much active, sometimes active enough to move down into the more southern regions of the northern hemisphere. I know there's been activity where with some really high geomagnetic activity that I've missed because I've been aboard ship and, you know, not able to get topside. Let me grab a nickel. Well, it's during those periods of high geomagnetic activity that the aurora gets developed, and the aurora is responsible for reflecting VHF signals, and therefore allowing long-distance QSOs to happen while pointing your antenna at the aurora. You can talk to just about anybody in the Northern Hemisphere. But anyway, that's the answer. I'll pause here and looking for any questions or any comments on this question. This is W4RFJ.
Okay, at this point, I believe we're going to throw it back to Gary. I think, Gary, you have the next question. Take it away.
And thank you, Mike, and indeed I do. And that is question number 5. This is G3B01. Okay, G3B01. And I would remind everybody, too, that if you're using the question pool as a reference and you're looking at these on your pool, don't memorize the designator that we give you, the ABCD. Don't memorize that, because on the actual test that you're going to take, the question will be there, but the answers may not be in that exact order. So remember the answer, don't remember the designator. Okay, so here we go. G3B01, how might a skywave signal sound if it arrives at your receiver by both short path and long path propagation? Now here's your choices. A, periodic fading every 10 seconds. B, signal strength increased by 3 dB. C, the signal might be canceled, causing severe attenuation. Or D, a well-defined echo might be heard. Well, this is one of the really cool things that happens out there from time to time. Matter of fact, it happened to me just the other night, and it was really neat. The answer that you want is D. Okay, and let me just give you a simplified explanation of what happens. Okay, you have two ways of getting to the point that you want to get to. Okay, that's directly short path, point A to point B. But sometimes radio waves take a very funny path too, and they bounce off the atmosphere, and they bounce back up into the atmosphere, and they bounce back on to the atmosphere, and next thing you know, it's coming to you from the opposite direction, and that's called the long path, and that's exactly what happened to me the other night. I was listening to a station. It was in South America, and I had that echo, and I said, "Aha, long path." You could definitely tell what that was, and it held up for a while. That is another thing that just for your information, this is probably nothing that's going to be on the test, but these phenomena, I mean, you have these hops, can last either a long time or they can be very brief and very exciting. You know, something might open up and you are going very far distances and doing some incredible stuff, and then it just goes poof. That's the way it is. But let's take some questions right now. Anybody out there have any questions, any comments? We'll open it up right now.
This is KD0CDQ. I noticed that Dave has a question, KG7UET. He wants to know what that term skywave, where this term skywave, what does that mean? You want to try to clarify that for him? It's in the text box. Over.
Sure thing, Mike. Okay, Dave, it's let's look at it this way. When the signal leaves your antenna, when that signal comes off your antenna, it goes out and it does kind of different things. Okay, part of it goes up into the sky. Okay, part of it goes up into the sky, and depending upon a lot of variables, depending upon the frequency that you're on and the condition of the atmosphere at that time. And a lot of other things. It's either going to go through an atmospheric layer and out into space, or it's going to take a bounce. Okay, and at any rate, they're all that component of the signal that goes up into the atmosphere is considered skywave. Now, you also have what's called a ground wave. Okay, and that is basically a local phenomenon. Okay, that is. Not a distance type of a phenomenon, okay? When we start talking about skywave, we're talking about the component of the radio signal that goes up into the air and is interplaying with the atmosphere. So I hope that that made some sort of sense to you. Do you have anything else to add to that? Nope, I guess I must have explained it. Okay. We'll go to question six now, and Roger. Roger, come on aboard.
Okay, this is W4RFJ. The question number six is G3B03. Which of the following applies when selecting a frequency for lowest attenuation when transmitting on HF? The answers are as follows. A, select a frequency just below the MUF. B, select a frequency just above the LUF. C, select a frequency just below the critical frequency. And D, select a frequency just above the critical frequency. Let me grab a nickel. The answer for this question is A, select a frequency just below the maximum usable frequency, or MUF. Now, MUF is a term that you'll learn to use when trying to determine whether or not you can communicate in any specific direction from your location. There are a bunch of computer programs, there's charts you can look at, and this all has to do with the sun, the sunspot cycle, its activity, what time of year, where the sun's shining on the planet, and that's why you're looking for a maximum usable frequency, what time of day, and what direction you'll be transmitting in. And I know it's kind of a hard subject to take in, but let me grab another nickel. If you remember, Gary and I were talking about the more flux coming from the sun, the more ionization you get on these D, E, and F layers. And the more ionization you get, the higher the usable frequency becomes. So at whatever time of day and whatever direction you're hoping to talk to, the maximum usable frequency is the highest frequency you can effectively use to bounce off the ionosphere. Otherwise, it's just going to go straight through. Okay, we'll pause for questions and see if anybody's got any remarks or anything coming back at me from this one. Hope I explained it well enough. This is W4RFJ.
Well, it looks like the next question will add a little bit more to that. So, Gary, you want to throw the next one at us, please?
And we thank you, sir. And we're going on to question number seven. We are moving right along here. This is G3B04, and it does kind of dovetail into the previous question that Roger had. Here we go. What is a reliable way to determine if the MUF is high enough to support skip propagation between your station and a distant location on the frequencies between 14 and 30 megahertz? A, listen for signals from an international beacon in the frequency range you plan to use. Or B, send a series of dots on the band and listen for the echoes from your signal. Or C, check the strength of TV signals from Western Europe. Or D, check the strength of signals in the MFAM broadcast band. Well, you know, as much as I'm a fan of Eurovision, that's just not going to play out. The actual answer here is A, listen. Listen for signals from an international beacon in the frequency range that you plan to use. Now, you may not know it, but there is a network of beacon stations. These are low-power beacon stations that are coordinated all over the world. And the beacon system works kind of like, you have, let's say, a group of 10 coordinated stations, and they will operate on low power and send a message, and then in one location, and then it goes to another location, and then to another location. So you kind of make a circle around the globe. Let me buy a nickel here. And then what happens is they drop power, and they repeat that, and then they drop power, and they repeat that. And you can tell once you get familiar with them, you'll know where they are. They have a schedule so that at 3 minutes past the hour, say, they're broadcasting on 5 watts, and at 4 minutes past the hour, they're, you know, on 1 watt. And you can evaluate the condition of the band by listening to these beacon stations. So once you get familiar enough with them, you will become kind of an artist, if you will, in learning how to do that. So, A, listen for those signals from the international beacon stations, okay? And notice, too, that in the question, all right, they're talking about the frequencies between 14 and 30 megahertz. These are the higher frequencies in the HF band, and these are generally what we consider to be DX bands. Okay, so let me throw it out for questions right now. Anybody have any questions, any comments?
This is KD0CDQ again. I think I mentioned last week that on your radio, I know my ICOM has it, there's an adjustment we can make to hear the beacons better. So I know I set it up years ago, and I have not had to go back and mess with that. But there's a setting where you can listen for the beacons and make sure that you're tuned. It helps you tune the radio, I would say. Gordon could probably explain it better, but it helps you tune right into those frequencies somehow or other, that you know you're clean. You're more clean when you hear those beacons. And on the Internet, you can find those beacons. You just kind of play around and Google, and it'll come up with the beacon where they're located, so you can know where they're located and you can know what the frequency they're in. Is there any other questions? Over.
It's KC2RMO. Mike, I do remember you talking about that, too. As a matter of fact, I was going to go and look to see if there was that setting on the FTDX 1200 because I you know, I tune around. I have the little list of beacons, and I'll tune around. I'll try and evaluate, you know, without that. I think that's a great feature. I don't know if that's just an ICOM feature or if it's available on all the new radios, but when you talked about that the other week, I said, hey, that's great stuff. So, you know, any other questions out there?
If I can add, it's a little control on the top of the radio. It's not on the face of it, but on the top. If I would leave her, I'd run down to my radio room and see what it's called. The knob has a name for it. I think I'll do that while Roger's doing the next question. I'll tell you what that little control is called. Over.
Okay, good deal. On the Yaesu, it's probably buried in one of the 200 menu items. That's a trip, too, but that's another story. Hey, let's continue, and let's go over to question 8 right now. Roger has that for us. So, Roger, take it away.
Thank you, Gary. I'm really confused as to what button he's talking about. I'm familiar with both pieces of equipment. But anyway, the next question is G3B12. And the question is, what factor or factors affect the MUF or maximum usable frequency? The answers are as follows. A, path, distance, and location. B, time of day and season. C, solar radiation and ionospheric disturbances. And D, all of the above choices are correct. Well, in this case, they are all correct. If you remember me answering question 6, I did talk about where you wanted to talk to, and that's one of the things that you got to be particularly focused on. The path distance and location makes a big difference as to what the maximum usable frequency is going to be. The time of day and the season, you know, that all tells you where the sun's going to be putting or pointing most of its energy on the face of the Earth and or into the ionosphere. And, of course, your solar radiation would be your spot sunspot number, ionospheric disturbances. They all play a part in what your maximum usable frequency is going to be. It could be as high as 18 megahertz talking into England, and let's say the highest you can go is 14 megahertz talking into South America. It can be different depending upon the distance and the location, the time of day and season, and, of course, the solar radiation and ionospheric disturbances. All of these choices are correct. Are there any questions on question number 8? This is W4RFJ.
Roger, this is KC2RMO. I just wanted to point out, too, that there are maps available online that have the contours that follow the path of the signal. for MUF. So you can do exactly what you said, where you can say, okay, I want to talk to England. What's my MUF for that? And you can find out that it's going to be, you know, 14 megahertz. I want to go to South America, and really my MUF is going to be, you know, 10 megahertz or whatever. So you can find those online as a resource. You just have to follow the contours on the map. Back to you.
Absolutely, Gary. And another thing to keep in mind, too, is there are programs, there's computer programs. I know I've got them on my Android. I use them quite a bit. And, you know, the fact that the amateurs have bands spread across the entire spectrum make it a neat tool for us to use to at least plan on our QSOs or try to establish communication in the different areas. So that's all I've got. I guess it's over to Mike to tell us what that control is.
Yes, I dragged my manual up here. I think it's the monitor switch. Now, I have the ICOM 751, which came out in sometime in the 1980s. It's not a new rig, so they might have taken it off, but I think it's the monitor switch, which says in the single sideband transmit mode, the transmitting IF signal can be monitored by turning this switch on. At this time, use headphones or reduced receiver audio volume to prevent howling. And it goes on to say this switch also turns the CW side tone circuit on and off in the CW mode. I think that's the control that I messed with a few years ago. Maybe and maybe not. Over.
Kind of sounds to me that's kind of like the headphone monitor on the FTDX. I know the monitor switch on that. You plug that and you can hear your transmitted audio coming through your headphones. So it might be maybe different on the Yaesu. I don't know, but that sounds to me like it's like a local monitor.
I would have to agree with you, Gary. That monitor gives you the ability to ensure that you're putting out a good tone. It doesn't have anything to do with receiving beacons. I don't think I've ever, you know, unless you put a filter in place to narrow your receive IF, the monitor you're talking about is a way for you to make sure that you're not chirping when you're sending your CW out. Okay, that's all I got to share. W4RFJ.
Maybe Mike, you had one in a memory. Does that radio have a memory bank or memory bank?
Oh, yes, it has a memory bank. I'm going through the manual. While y'all are enjoying these good questions, I'm going through my manual to see if I can find it in here. I got a little mimeographed copy of the original manual, so I'll check it out. Okay, I think, is it Gary? I think you have the next question. Is that correct? Over.
Yes, I do. That's awesome. I want to know the answer to this. I want to find the Yaesu equivalent to this, because I want my monitor. I want my beacon. Thanks, Mike. We're going to go on to question G3, C as in Charlie 01, and we're going to kind of move off of this maximum usable frequency and minimal usable frequency stuff, and we're going to talk a little bit about layers, okay? And the question reads, which ionospheric layer is closest to the surface of the Earth? And here's your choices. A, the D layer. B, the E layer, C, the F1 layer, or D, the F2 layer. Now the question is A, or the answer rather, is A. The answer is A for G3C01, the D layer. And it's real easy. You know, this isn't rocket science on the layers, okay? D, E, F1, F2. D is closest to you. F2 is the farthest from you. Now, let me buy a nickel, and I just want to throw a concept at you, too, while we're talking about this, because this is a good point to introduce it. Okay, you'll notice that we go D being closest, F2 the furthest away. Remember this, that the highest or farthest away layer, okay, is going to get you the furthest signal increase, the furthest distance on your signal. Is going to come from the highest layer. And of course, that makes sense. You go up a long ways, and it's going to bounce a long way. The angles is going to be such that it's going to go a long way. So it's a simple concept, but it's an important concept to remember, too. So D being the closest, F2 being the furthest away. Let's open it up for questions right now.
6, Victor.
Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Gary, as a little aside here, not absolutely germane to this specific question, but as they get into hamming on the various bands, they're going to find this out pretty quick. The D layer being the closest to us has the most effect on the lower frequencies, such as 75 and 80 and 160 and sometimes 40. And the reason for that is the D layer during the daytime absorbs the signals, where in the evening and the nights the band is much more active because it's got some propagation to it. Just a little aside. Go ahead, Gary, KY6V.
And that would be what you'd call an excellent point, sir. Not only that, but that D layer is going to vary through the course of the year too. You're going to its characteristics are going to vary too. But it's an important concept for people to kind of latch onto, that those layers, that the Earth's atmosphere is kind of like a layer cake, you know, and every one of them has its own little surprise, you know. But you're right, the D layer is going to be probably the one that's going to affect you the most. You will be experiencing phenomenon from other layers as well, but the D is going to be the one that you're going to be dealing with the most. So very good point, Gordon. Thank you very much for that. We move on, I guess, to question 10 now. So over to Roger.
Okay, thank you, Gary. This is W4RFJ with G3Charlie03. Why is the F2 region mainly responsible for the longest distance radio wave propagation? The answers are as follows. A, because it is the densest ionospheric layer. B, because it does not absorb radio waves as much as other ionospheric regions. C, because it is the highest ionospheric region, and D. All of these choices are correct. Well, playing right along with Gary's explanation from the earlier question, the answer is C, because it is the highest ionospheric region. And, you know, sometimes, most of the time, you have your D, E, and F layers, and it's during different amounts of ionization that give you your F1 and F2 layers. The F layer actually splits up and moves further away to give you the F2 layer, which also gives you bigger or longer distances. And it's just increasing the angle, so to speak, of the wave. I guess that's the only way I can really explain this one. I'm looking forward to the last one. So any questions on why the F2 region mainly responsible for the longest distance radio wave propagation? Please call now. This is W4RFJ.
Going back to calibrating for the beacons, I believe, gentlemen, I believe it's the marker calibrator it's called. Marker calibrator calibrates the marker frequency with a standard frequency such as the WWV. Would that be the control, gentlemen?
Maybe. I mean, maybe to me, that could be just something like, you know, you're testing the accuracy of the radio against a frequency source, you know, like the National Bureau of Standards. But it could maybe something to do with a beacon. Got me thinking about that. But marker calibration, I'm going to have to look at that. Roger, any comment?
Not while you're keyed up, Gary. This is W4RFJ. About the only comment I have is, you know, in order to ensure that you're receiving the proper beacon, you may want to calibrate your markers so that your dial is reading correctly. You know, your frequency accuracy is what I would mainly use that for. But that's just me. Okay, Mike. Sorry, couldn't be much more help. W4RF check.
Roger, I think you're on the right track, because I remember when I was when I would slowly make the adjustments, a very slight adjustment, that a slight adjustment would either raise or lower the beacon signal coming back to me. I remember that, and once I got it set in a certain place a few years ago, I left that sucker alone. I don't mess with that control. Okay, let's go back to Gary. Over. This is South Coast Amateur Radio Service, by the way, doing the general class questions from the ARRL. Back to you.
Hey, thank you, Mike. And yeah, I got a that PTT was kind of hanging up on me there. So, but that's maybe it, huh? I'll be checking those menus for something like a marker calibration and see how we make out with the beacons. But thank you, Mike. Another mystery solved by South Cars, you know. Let's move it along to question 11 now. This is G3C05. G3C as in Charlie 05. Why is long-distance communication on the 40-meter, 60-meter, 80-meter, and 160-meter bands more difficult during the day? Your answers are A, the F layer absorbs more signals at these frequencies during the daylight hours. B, the F layer is unstable during the daylight hours. C, the D layer absorbs signals at these frequencies during the daylight hours. Or D, the E layer is unstable during the daylight hours. Now, kind of had a clue a little bit earlier on this one. Let me buy a nickel. And the clue was exactly what Gordon was talking about, okay? The correct answer for number 11 is C. The D layer absorbs signals at these frequencies during the daylight hours, okay? If it's getting sucked up by the D layer, it's not going any higher. You know, the elevator stops at that floor, and you're not going to get any bounce. That's basically it right there. So long-distance communication on the lower bands, 40, 60, 80, and 160, is more difficult during the day because the signal never makes it to the higher layers. It just gets sucked up by that D. Any questions?
For those out there that may be AM or FM radio junkies, you know, commercial radio, at night I can pick up Chicago. And during the day, it's not to be had. You can't have it. But I can pick up Denver and I can pick up Chicago. Those are the two that I know at the night when it's cool and it's dark, you know. And I always also attribute it to maybe there's less interference from all kind of motors and whatnot's going on during the daytime. But I think that has to do something also. Also with the D layer. It could be. Okay, just a little tidbit to throw in there. Let's go on.
Well, let me throw something in there too, Mike, while you're talking about it. One of the things as a kid that got me into ham radio and into shortwave listening and ham radio and radio in general was the ability to listen to DX stations at night. I'd be sitting up here in Syracuse listening to Mexico on the AM band, you know, when you got a good break in the atmospherics, and just shows you how long a trip those broadcast signals can make. Hey, we're heading on down to the last question, and Roger's got it, so let's move on to question 12. Roger, take it away.
Well, I was hoping to make another comment.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, something that brings to mind some local activity that I don't know if you guys remember, but here recently there's been some negotiating about moving the 40-meter broadcast stations off the amateur spectrum, mainly due to the fact that, you know, during part of the day we could use 40 meters to talk all over the world, and then all of a sudden, as soon as the sun went down or certain time in the evening, those signals would start hitting that F layer and coming right over and just shutting us down. Do you guys remember that?
I'll tell you one thing. I'll personally hold the picket sign in front of the FCC to get rid of those stations. I hate that. Mike, what do you say?
Well, if you're going to go to Washington, D.C., make sure you get some hoagies or something, a nice sandwich off those carts out there to keep America rich. That's all I can say. Over.
Well, the reason why I bring it up is this is a perfect opportunity to witness what is happening with propagation throughout the day, especially on 40 meters. Now, I know the South Cars nets usually land usually operate in the middle of the day, but, you know, there have been times that I've been talking to somebody, and all of a sudden you get this AM broadcast station coming in. Now, they've been transmitting all day long, but it's just the propagation changes that brings their signal over into our area that kind of, you know, shuts us down. But anyway, that, you know, being as we're talking about propagation, it just came to my mind that that would be a perfect opportunity if anybody has access to an HF rig, just receive only, you know, tune up some 40 meters and listen to it throughout the day, and you can see and hear, mostly hear, the differences as propagation progresses. Anybody got any questions on that? If not, I'll go ahead and get into the last question.
This KC2RMO with a comment, Roger, and I'll throw it back to you, or actually I'll throw it for any further questions, and then if there aren't any, why not you pick it up? I just wanted to point out that maybe some of these things that we're talking about, 40 meters, 60 meters, 80 meters, 160 meters, this might be kind of a foreign-sounding language to some people that are, you know, maybe out there holding a technician ticket. We're talking about, we're describing this whole new world that's going to be open to you when you get that general ticket. Your horizons are going to be vastly broadened, and it's a pretty cool world too. I think you're going to like it. So, Roger, anybody else have any comments? If not, Roger, pick it up.
Well, about the only thing I'll say to add to that, Gary, is when you get your general class license, it does open you up to being a representative of the United States. You become a diplomat in a sense, because you become eligible to communicate with people all over the world, and that to me is a good thing. All right, if there's no other comments or questions, I will move into our last question of the evening. Okay, hearing none, this is W4RFJ with our last question, G3Charlie13. What is near vertical incident sky wave, otherwise known as NVIS, propagation? And the answers are as follows. A, propagation near the MUF for maximum usable frequency. B, short distance MF, medium frequency, or HF, high frequency propagation using high elevation angles. C, a long path HF propagation at sunrise and sunset. And D, double hop propagation near the LUF. Let me buy a nickel. Okay, if everybody got all that, the answer is B, short distance MF or HF propagation using high elevation angles. Now, I might want to add to this, it basically is developed or has been developed to find a way to communicate to areas that are closer than what you can talk to on ground wave, and not as far away as what you would need a big hop to talk to. If you look at that area between where you're talking to and where you are, and you need to talk to them people in that area, this is what's going to give it to you. Let me explain in simpler terms how it's going to work, but I'm going to grab another nickel. If you took a mirror and you took a flashlight and you shined it right directly into that mirror, the beam of light would come back directly at you. Okay? If you tilt it at an angle, you'll notice that beam starts moving away from you. So we're looking at the angle that your RF energy is hitting the ionosphere. And what happens is when you bring your antenna closer to the ground, the near incidence, vertical incidence of the wave bouncing off the ground goes almost directly straight up or at higher angles than if your antenna was at higher in the air. So what happens is those medium frequencies or high frequencies we're talking about in the HF spectrum are able to communicate in closer up areas than what you would normally consider DX. One area that we use this is in the amateur radio emergency service. We need to talk to people closer to us than overseas, and setting up your antenna in an NVIS configuration helps in that matter. Okay, I think I've confused it enough. Any questions? W4RFJ. You mean I explained that well enough for everybody to understand it?
I think you did. The mirror and the flashlight, very good. You know, and that's something that if you get bored, you can try for yourself. You know, but that made perfect sense.
Yes, that was good. That you brought me back to high school physics. I remember the teacher doing something with a flashlight, waking me up somehow or other, flashing the light around the room. You know, the explanations tonight, I think, were very interesting. I enjoyed them, for one. I enjoyed the explanations. It's always good to listen to different people's slant and say the same thing with different words. I think that's how we learn. You know, we shape a picture. We all see a picture, and sometimes we don't understand the explanations, but when someone else gives their definition or their description, oh, that's what you mean. I appreciate that very much from both of you, Gary and Roger. It was very good this evening. I like those illustrations. I can actually see the picture of what you're speaking about. Anybody else have any comments? Come on, we still got a few minutes, and then we'll shut this down for the evening. Anyone have any comments about any of the questions in the group that was covered tonight? Not just the 12 questions, but is there any question in the group that we covered that's giving you a hang-up or you'd like a better explanation or hear a tale about it? Go ahead now, please, with any comments you might have. Over.
Well, if nobody's going to comment, I just want to give a comment of my own. And first of all, it's thank you to Mike and for the nice words and for you hosting these classes, because that is a valuable service to a lot of people. And I know I'm holding the extra ticket because of these South Cars Outreach courses, and I know it's helped a lot of people get a license, that's for sure. So thank you, Mike. And secondly, to the folks out there that are aspiring to holding that general class ticket, study, 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 study. Back to you.
Yes, this is KD0CDQ. Now, I haven't checked it lately, but I remembered way back when I took the general and the extra. The general, about half of it was technical questions from the technical class, as if they want to refresh your memory. And there might have been some in the extra as well. But feel comfortable. I always thought of the general as a half step. It's not a critical step like extra runs into. That much of it is a repeat of the technical class, the technical license. Kind of a refresher maybe to make sure that you still got it together. That's what it seemed to me. But again, go for that general. It's a good step to be in. And the extra, that gets a little more studying because it's kind of blurred to me. Sometimes if you don't have an engineering background, electrical engineering background, you really got to study the question and the answer to see what are they saying? What are they saying here? What should I know? But the general's not too terrible as far as I thought. Anybody have any comments about the step of the general exam, tech general and extra? Any questions about those steps? Over.
I have a comment about tonight's subject.
Oh, please, go ahead with that.
Well, you know, I always do a lot of Googling and research to help me find better ways to teach or explain different aspects of technology, being a technical instructor. And I just want to add, I did find a document that was put out about solar indices that I wouldn't mind sharing the URL for, but I would prefer people to email me and ask for it, and then I will send it. That way I don't interfere with what the course here is adding. But I found it very useful, and if anybody's interested in it, just email me and I'll for the URL, W4RFJ.
Okay, we're just 2 minutes from the top of the hour. I think we had a very good class. I enjoyed it tonight. I enjoyed the whole thing, actually. Then next Tuesday again at 7 p.m. Eastern, we're going to have Roger and Gary back. Now, I know that Gary's in Syracuse, New York. I think, Roger, I think you're in Ridley Park, Pennsylvania, and if that is so, I don't know where Ridley Park, Pennsylvania is. Could you fill us in a little bit on that, Roger? Over.
Sure, Mike. I'm a little south and west of Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love.
Very good. Thank you for that. I'm an East Coast person, and there's so many communities that we don't really know where they are. We think we do. I know where Syracuse is. I didn't know where Ridley Park was. Thank you for that. Okay, so again, we'll have the two instructors, W4RFJ and KC2RMO, coming this Tuesday night. Don't miss it. It should be quite interesting again. And this is a good time to ask everyone. This is the time that Gordon has to turn off the recorders. He has a couple or so recorders going. So if we give it a minute of silence and give Gordon a chance, he will come back and tell us when we can start speaking again. So let's go silent so he can turn off the controls. This is KD0CDQ.
This has been the South Cars Outreach Program. Join us again next time for another in our series of training sessions for amateur radio operators. Goodbye for now.